Welcome back to the Who Should I Be Talking To podcast. I'm Jason Price, your host. And today we have a follow-up guest from Nick. Nick recommended Liam Corcoran. And I'm excited to give you this episode because Liam is very accomplished. He was in a band called 2 Hours Traffic. They shut things down around 13 years or so after they started. And they're on a resurgence now. So they've toured all over the world. He's also a solo performer. He's got some stuff coming up that we'll get into. And he is a program manager for the School of the Performing Arts at Holland College in PEI. So, awesome guest. Here he is, Liam Corcoran. Over who I've been and what I've done and where I've slept and when I've gone. Why I'm here, how I'm so mean, and who, how, why, what, when, and where the hell I've been. Hey, and welcome back to the Who Should I Be Talking To podcast. And as promised, I have Liam Corcoran. Liam, did I say that right?
Yeah, that was very good. Most people would not do that well on the first pronunciation. So
I am three for three now. Three for three. I got Nick Donoff and Kelsey Sharon, and now I got yours. So that's awesome.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm hooked on phonics. Okay, let's get into this a little bit. I'm just going to check something here, Liam, because there we go. Perfect. All right. So, yeah, first question, always, with every guest, how do you know the last guest? So how did you run into Nick Donoff? He's given us a little background, maybe, but I'm interested in your take.
Yeah, so Nick's from Ontario, and I'm from Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, and have lived here my whole life. And Nick went to Humber College in Toronto, he started dating someone there. She was from Nova Scotia, but after they graduated, they found their way to PEI and set up shop here. And Nick, being a great musician and a really nice guy, I eventually crossed paths with him. I heard he had a really nice acoustic guitar, an old Gibson. One of my other musician friends tipped me off. So I just kind of cold called him and asked if I could borrow this guitar for a recording session. And I think he was like, who is this guy? And why is he asking me for my guitar? But that struck up a friendship, and he's now involved, heavily involved in everything I do. He's just a great, musically, he's just a great guitar player, keyboardist, just a guy to talk about music with. So we work on all kinds of stuff together now, but we're really close, and I think he's going to stay in Charlottetown forever, we hope. So he's an honorary Islander now.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Well, that's hard to do. That's hard to become.
It's hard to get that title for sure.
That was always the come from away. Oh, he's from away. I remember a time I lived in Summerside for about a year.
Okay.
And there was something in the paper. It struck me. It was in the obituary. For some reason, I was reading it. I was way back then, way back. I was young. And it said, Islander dies in Los Angeles, 96 years old. And moved there. You read on. He moved there when he was like 2 years old, but he's still an Islander. And then the opposite, just one down, was someone else who was like 85 years old, moved here from Ontario when he was 5. Person from Ontario dies at
whatever. I mean, that's a perfect illustration of what it's like.
I thought it was so funny, man. I was like, oh, that's cool.
That's awesome.
So tell me you're from PEI. So people that don't know who you are, like, what would you say for your background? Like at first, I guess where you grew up and how life was for you growing up before we get into some of the stories you got.
Sure. So I grew up right in the heart of Charlottetown. I've certainly traveled a lot in my life, but this has always been home and continues to be home. I have a family of my own now. My wife and I have 3 children, and we live about you know, a 30-second drive or a 2-minute walk from where I grew up with my parents. So, yeah, just grew up in Charlottetown, played a lot of, I was more of a sports guy growing up and played a lot of hockey and baseball. And when I got to high school, I kind of started making this. I always loved music, but I certainly wasn't known as a musician. And I'd been writing songs since 13 or 14, and I kind of emerged to the public as a musician when I was maybe 17 or 18. And a lot of my friends were like, where did this come from? But it was just something I kind of did in private. And then now I'm more known as a musician and an educator in my day job. So that's an overview anyways of me.
What type of songs would you have been writing back at like 13? Like what would you have, do you look back at it? Like, have you rewritten any of them even, or?
My friends who we'd be down in his basement work. He was a good guitar player. His name is Patrick McDonald, and he ended up playing in a bunch of bands himself, but he would play the guitar and I would write the lyrics and sing. And yeah, what was I writing about? That's a funny one. Like I didn't have a whole lot to draw on, but there were these, I think you're kind of imitating the songs you love. So we did find some of those lyrics recently and they're, you know, as you can imagine, kind of cringeworthy, but the, you know, I was trying.
Yeah, for sure, man. Yeah. I mean, I remember because I didn't get into music until really late, like 38. And, I remember writing one, for some reason, I just kind of wrote two songs and neither of them would I be able to find, but I just, I do remember, which is crazy, the lyrics to one of them, which is, wow. Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, which is and definitely needs a rewrite. Like it's
not yeah, first draft.
yeah, for sure. What kind of sports were you in? You're saying you're so you're into hockey. What about what age are you now?
I'm 38 now.
Okay, so I didn't play against you, but I was in PEI and played some hockey over there too.
Okay. I was okay at hockey. I wasn't a great skater, but I was pretty good with the puck. And I played, I played on some AAA teams and ended up playing Junior B was my last, there's a Junior B league in PEI. Mm-hmm. And I played on the Sherwood team for that for a couple of years. And, even got the call up to the Junior A Abbeys a couple of times. So, That was the end of the hockey line for me. But I actually, after midget, I actually went to Ontario and tried out for a tier two team. Like I took it pretty seriously for a while. Yeah. But it definitely wasn't in the cards for me to go a whole lot farther than that. But, some cool experiences in hockey. And then I actually was even more fond of baseball and played on some of the island rep teams and went to some nationals and stuff. So yeah, I was definitely big into sports for a good part of my life, but I've pretty much completely left that behind. I don't do rec league or anything anymore. I just completely shifted. So
really, I'm in similar boat. We, I'll jump in and I coach a little bit now, but I was similar to you. Yeah. I was heavy into sport and, yeah, and now just the old ECMA hockey game you get in once in a while. And
yeah, I've done a few of those.
Yeah, man. Yeah, fun.
You start to get that call because they're just searching for anyone who can skate. And yeah, definitely.
Awesome.
I was a big runner too. I sometimes like ran competitively, and then my knees – stop cooperating with me, but I miss that for sure. But if I tried to go for a run now, I couldn't walk tomorrow.
Really? Wow.
I inherited that from my father, the bad knees, bad back.
Oh no. Oh shit. That's tough. Do you know Spencer Gallant by chance?
I do know Spencer a little bit.
Yeah. Spencer was on the show here. And so it's funny cause, I'm not sure if he recommended Lawrence and then recommended Nick and yourself. But I know he played hockey in that same league, I think was like a Junior B league. And I think he's around your age. So I wonder if you might know him.
I'm a little bit older than him. So I think I missed him in that league. But
okay.
I'm pretty sure I have a younger brother. I think he might be right in between the two of us. But yeah, I've gotten to know Spencer a little bit through his business pursuits and stuff the last few years. But yeah, he's a good guy.
Super fella. Yeah, it was cool to have him on the show. So here's a good question for you that I think. I'm giving myself credit for a good question, but that's normally what the guest says. Good question. what would you draw from sport that you would bring into music? So you know, there's a number of life lessons and stuff and a number of things that sport gives you, I think, but what would you have drawn from sport that would have benefited your music?
I think there's an element of leadership for me. I was never one to kind of put my hand up and say, I want to be the leader here. I want to be the captain. But I did end up in some leadership roles in sport, which I think translated to when I was in bands, because in certain situations, it wasn't me asking for it, but I just became the default kind of spokesperson or doing the interviews or being the one who had to have the hard conversation with, you know, we used to have a manager and a label and all that stuff. So that there's a parallel there, I think. And it's funny you ask, because like, I haven't mentioned it yet, but most of my music career that people would know me for is in the band 2 Hours Traffic, which was like an indie rock band that I played in for, we still play. It's been going, I've been in it since I was 18 and can't seem to get out of it. <It's>, like we actually revived the band about 5 years ago. We did totally stop for a while there, but that's been a huge part of my life. And Derek Ellis, the drummer in 2 Hours Traffic, was a excellent hockey player. On a much higher level than I was, but we played against each other sometimes. And we talk about many times in the van touring around, we talk about like our sporting memories, and it just becomes imprinted on your mind. You can't, even if you stop playing like I did, it's still a huge part of your kind of how you grew up. And, you know, and as you know, it's where you face a lot of adversity growing up. It's not real adversity. It's not going to end your life, but it's you suffer defeats and you have triumphs and all that. So it's just part of your story, I guess. But I don't know. I wonder about that too. What those parallels? I can think of a few, but there might be others I'm missing.
Ones I always consider is when I. Because I was and for me in sport, I made a career in sport after I got, you know, done playing a little bit. And I just found that it was, you had to bring it still. You know what I mean? Like in music, you have to bring it. There's an audience there and you still have to bring it. Like you have to have your A game or people see it. You look like shit. You know what I mean?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
You have to, you know, just like there's whether it's a game or whether it's a concert, there are days when you might not be feeling it, but you've got to dig deep and do it. Someone came, you know, your teammates need you, your band needs you. That's something we talked about a lot. Like I toured heavily through my 20s and there were a lot of days I just thought, geez, I don't want to go up there tonight. Seriously. I'm just not feeling it. So you've got to psych yourself up in whatever way you know how. And I know Derek, who I mentioned earlier, he would always disappear right before he went on. And he had this little routine he had to do and kind of look at himself in the mirror and you know, you have to do what you have to do.
I was going to actually even bring it up. I would, like any game day routines, like any kind of game music day routines or show day routines. So that's funny because that's another one.
Yeah. Like I just, for me, you kind of feel rude sometimes, but if you're going up there to sing for 75 minutes, you kind of have to give yourself some space and let your voice rest for a little while. And sometimes some nights you're just not good at that. Maybe there's old friends at the show or something and you end up, you know, yelling and screaming for the show. So that was difficult for me to give myself space for a proper, you know, routine, warm up routine. I wasn't great at it.
Would you have a warm up? Like, so I know some other artists and that like they go through scales and stuff like this, like they do an actual warm up and then a cool down. I've heard one guy, Brett Kissel actually did a cool down. And I was like, I was outside his trailer and was like, what is he doing? It's a cool down. And I went, well, yeah, it, of course it's muscle. Yeah.
Well, my career has led me to like I trained after I stopped touring with the band. I went to back to school to get my teaching degree. So I'm in education now, and now I'm at, I have this amazing job at Holland College in Charlottetown, and I manage some different programs, one of them being the music performance program. So now I work every day with a bunch of great musician teachers, but several of them are vocal teachers. And if I told them the way I used to tour and what I used to do, I mean, they're just horrified. So through them, I've learned like some very good techniques that I should have been using all along. But if you really follow all the advice, absolutely, there'd be routines before, there'd be routines during, there'd be routines after. I mean, you can't do enough to take care of your voice. And I've certainly had nights where I just blew it out completely, and I had different we had different tricks to get around that. Like usually if I could rest my voice for about 10 minutes, I could get it back. So we might have another guy in the band could sing one, or maybe there's an extended instrumental, but I, you know, you found these little workarounds, but I definitely wasn't taking the best care of my voice there.
Man, yeah, I believe I do that probably the worst, like coffee and
oh yeah,
drinking beer during the show. Yeah.
I don't smoke cigarettes. That's in my favor. But I, you know, definitely, you know, the coffee and the alcohol and everything is not good.
It's not what you're supposed to be doing. Yeah, nope. Yeah, that's funny. So at you said so around 13 you started writing, and then came out as a writer about 18. You said around right when you're getting into 2 hours traffic, or was it a little before that?
It all kind of, except for a few little things I would have done when I was a bit younger. I met Alec O'Hanley, is who I started 2 hours traffic with, and we were grade 11, I believe. So it all kind of happened at the same time. We were an acoustic duo for at least 2 years before then we got to UPEI, and Andy and Derek joined on drums and bass, or bass and drums, I should say. And so we're certainly known as this rock band, indie rock band, or whatever you want to call it. But we wrote lots of songs and recorded lots of songs as a duo, just with our acoustic guitars. So,
yeah. Awesome. Is that where your influence would have been, with more rock stream, or what would you have kind of started with?
I've always been almost, I would say, equally influenced on two sides. And it shows up in the music I make is kind of the rock and roll type of bands, which can be anything from, you know, like classic stuff like Tom Petty up to, you know, more alternative stuff like the Pixies and Beck and all this stuff. But I've always loved, really loved acoustic music. Like Bob Dylan was my first loves, and anyone who can, you know, keep your attention with their songs and their guitar, that's always something I loved as well. And I think most of the guys in the band and that I've collaborated with have similar influences. So if you look through my recorded output, you know, you'll have the full-on rockers, and then, you know, there'll be the acoustic numbers as well. So that's all, there's always that mixture in most of the things that I do.
Awesome. Cool. And so at 18 you got, or grade 11, you formed this
band.
So
I was actually more like 16, I suppose, but we were pretty slow to, again, it was mostly secretive what we were doing, because we were just so nervous to show anybody. But by the time we were in that transition, like graduating high school, then starting university, we started to do like all ages shows and whatever kind of stage we could get on. And we eventually got a weekly summer gig, which is the coveted Monday night slot at Myron's in Charlottetown, it was called. So we'd play out in the like if you're walking by the on the street, and when you look in the window, you would see the kind of restaurant portion, and that's where we played every Monday night. And it was great. I mean, we cut our teeth. We had to fill a whole bunch of time. So we had a few originals, but we had to play all kinds of covers, and our friends would come, and that was enough to keep the bar happy on a Monday night and they make a little bit of money. But I think you need to be thrown into something like that where you're not really ready to do it, but you've just got to rise to the occasion and figure it out.
Baptized by fire. Yeah.
Totally.
And learning what happens when a string breaks. What do I do? Oh my God. What happens when my cord doesn't work?
All that good stuff. We had lots of time to figure those things out.
So as you, got transitioned, I guess, into a more touring band, how did you get away from, or did you get away from, the covers as well? Like, so, I mean, a Monday night at a pub or even a Friday, whenever night at a pub, it's normally pretty much loaded with covers. And as you got your originals out there and you did one or two, like, how did you transition from going from that band to an original band that's touring?
It was quite gradual. When we graduated from that Myron's gig, then we started playing the venues that hosted like the cool original bands, be local or touring, like small spots like Bob's Lounge. That's kind of where we started playing next. And then we were kind of a half and half. We had maybe 6-7 originals. We were playing them all, but then we were playing like a Radiohead song, a Beck song, a Spoon song. A lot of the people who would watch us play, which in the beginning is mostly just people we knew, our friends, they got hooked on some of those covers. And then we started to phase them out and they're like, why aren't you playing that Spoon song anymore? And we're like, well, if we're going to be taken seriously as an original band, we kind of have to move to mostly original sets. And Joel Plaskett became a mentor to us along the way. Somehow we got one of our EPs, like we had a 6-song recording and it got into his hands right around the time when he was looking to get into production. So it was just really good timing. And I remember he came over to watch us play at Bob as we were just kind of figuring each other out and seeing if we wanted to work together. And I remember he did an opening slot. Like, I don't think we announced it. I think he just went up and did a few songs and then we played. And first thing he said, he's like, no more covers, guys. Like, no, nothing against the covers. He's like, but you guys got to form your own identity with your own songs, and your own songs are really good. Now we said, that's all we got. Like, we only had 7 or something. He's like, well, you got to write more. So he was just very blunt about that. And we very much took his advice and then got to the point where we might just do one or two, pepper in two covers in a set. But from that point on, it was like, okay, we got to write.
Yeah. And did you plan then to get like a full hour and a half or, 75 minute show, or were you like breaking it up into 45 minute sets still?
It took many years before we did a full 75 minute set. We did a lot of like opening tours and things like that. And even when we do our own headlining show, we probably shoot for 60 minutes. But that was really hard for us to get to those kind of milestones of time in the set, because we wrote really short pop songs, like 3 minutes. We didn't often go beyond 3 minutes, sometimes less. And we weren't big, like, solo people. There wasn't going to be this long instrumental. Like, we were just song. So that was one part we really struggled with, because once you get to a certain point in the industry, people are expecting at least 60, sometimes 75. And the number of times we were at a festival and they said, good show, but you owe us like 8 more minutes. And we just kind of went, I don't know what to tell you.
I know a few jokes.
Exactly. Once we played at the Harvest, well, we played there a few times, but Harvest Jazz and Blues in Fredericton, there was a stage manager, I think 3 times we went off and he just kind of pushed us back up there to play another one, which some point, like, I don't know. I've always struggled with that because I get it. You have to fill up your nights and stuff, but a crowd doesn't always need to hear you for 70 minutes and maybe 60 is okay on some nights. I don't know. I'm on more quality over quantity, but we've definitely got ourselves in a bit of trouble a few times by rushing through our set, if you will.
That's true. Yeah. I've heard more on the opposite side, like guys that are kind of scolded for going over their set too.
We've never had that problem, but either way, you're going to get scolded. So yeah. Unless you're bang on.
Just put the clock right beside the monitor. Yeah, I'll be fine.
I'll have the phone now. Obviously we learned some tricks over the years, but we'll time it and be looking at our phones, and we're better now at fulfilling what we said we were going to do.
But it kind of distracts you a little bit too. It must, you know,
like, it's tough. It's tough to really have a great flow to your set and completely, you know, give that exact amount of time. Some people are good at it, but we're still figuring it out all these years later.
Yeah. Cool. So you guys ended up getting signed. Is that right? We were on a label
out of Toronto called Bumstead, and it was one of those 360 deals where we signed one contract, which was management, label, and publishing. They're popular at the time, and that was right when the music industry. I guess the music industry seems like it's constantly in transition now, but that was really when it was like. Everything was changing. Digital was becoming more prominent, and these new kinds of deals were getting structured. Anyways, we didn't really know what we were signing, to be quite honest with you, at that time. We were so young, like we were maybe 19, maybe 20. And Larry Wanagas was the label owner and the manager. And Larry was a legendary dude in the industry. He came up through the ranks straight out of the prairies with Katie Lang. Like they were a pair.
No way.
So
cool.
Larry was young. He wanted to get into the music industry. Katie's is, you know, obviously very talented young person. And this is before anyone knew who she was. And they literally did it together. Like to the point where he sat there and watched those black and white show rehearsals with Roy Orbison. Like he got to the top of the industry with Katie Lang. So he had a lot of, recognition around the industry, and he liked our stuff and always supported us. So that was cool. I mean, he was our entry into like the quote unquote industry, and he treated us well. And Larry actually passed away a few years ago, which was really sad, but he was, he was a wonderful guy.
Wow. Jeez. Is he the only manager you guys had then, or?
Like, yeah.
As you went through?
Yeah, he was pretty much it. There was some really good people that went through his office that he kind of mentored. So there is a guy named Tim Desilet who now has his own company called Noisemaker Management. He lives in Ontario. He's doing amazingly well and manages some bands. Tim is now a guy that if I have questions or 2 hours traffic is in a weird situation, he would be kind of our unofficial manager, and we'll go to him graciously help us out, because there's always things that'll come up. You go, I don't know what the heck to do with this offer or whatever.
Yeah.
And he owes us a little bit, because Noisemaker is he named his company after one of our songs. So he never turns us down. We'll say that when we need a little help.
That's wicked. Awesome. How long did you stay together before you, like, it was around what? I think I read 2010 or something.
I think it was, I might be wrong. I think it was 2012. Maybe we did our farewell. We did a farewell tour and made it very clear that, you know, we're going to stop doing this. And then it was a full, I believe it was almost exactly 5 years that we just, you know, we all stayed. We're all still close. Me and Andy and Derek, Alec, the guy I originally started with, he's now in the band Always, who do incredibly well, and tour around the world. But anyways, we all it was very amicable, the whole thing. But after we got this offer in 2018, just kind of out of nowhere. It was when cannabis was becoming legalized and companies were throwing all this money around, throwing all these big parties. So it was a cannabis company that approached us kind of through a promoter and with a big offer. And we were like, do we want to do this? And we, Nick, who I didn't even mention before, it's funny because I'm involved with so many things with him.
Yeah.
we didn't have a guitar player. So Nick was the obvious choice. And man, he's done an amazing job stepping into a pretty tough role. Like the guitar work in that band is pretty intricate and unique, and he's just done so well. Since that show in 2018, we kind of kept getting the odd offer, and we're now at the point here in 2023 where we're writing new material for the first time in 11 or 12 years. So
that's awesome.
We just kind of started to, like, we like playing, but we're like, we're going to get bored of this if we don't have some new material to work on. So that's been a lot of fun.
That's cool. Yeah. Have you noticed a difference in the writing since, I mean, you took a break, but there's a lot of life that happens inside that break. You said you have three kids now. That might influence, I would think.
Yeah. So I've got kids, Derek has kids. We've all have careers outside of music. So one thing we notice is that we are much better musicians than we were when we were actually doing this for a living, because everyone's stayed active in different ways. Andy has his own project called Golden Cinema. That's really cool. Derek plays in that. We all have different things. So we've continued to grow as musicians. So that was apparent that we're better musicians and we're better at communicating our musical ideas. I can say those two things for sure. And some of the songs we're writing are more of an evolution. They're a little more, slightly more complex, I would say, in terms of the way they're arranged. And then there's a couple where we've been able to kind of mine that old, like they almost sound like really old. We use THT for short, but like when we were like a couple of the songs sound like we're like 20 again, which is a lot of fun. But it's good. Like I think the songs are strong. We're looking at recording some stuff in the next 3 or 4 months. So it's just been like, at the end of the day, it's what we love to do. Like we love performing and all that, but when you're down in the basement and a new song starts to come together, that's the kind of high we're chasing. So it's nice to be doing that again.
That's cool, man. How do you guys structure it? Like on song credits and stuff, does everybody have a piece or are you more a solo writer?
One of Larry's suggestions early on, and I know a number of people said this, they were like, if you guys are a real band where you're all in it together, they said, just split it evenly. Because if you start to get into, we know bands that do that thing where like, oh, I have 15% on this song, I have 7%, I have 70%. It's like the energy that goes into that and the kind of animosity that can start to form if you're thinking, okay, well, why do I want to put effort into the next song? Because the last one, they didn't give me any credit on. Like I'm glad we took the advice to go, just screw that. Split it up evenly. We're all in it together. Now, some songs, do people do more heavy lifting than others? Sure. But we were all contributing ideas. So we just kept it even. And I'm very thankful we did. I think I can guarantee we wouldn't be playing music together right now if we were breaking things up in a different way. Because once you do start to make a little money, like that can go sour really quickly. And I've seen it happen to so many bands. I won't name them, but there's a lot of bands that started off kind of as a democracy, and then management came in and said, okay, you're the lead singer. And then we're going to structure it that the rest of the guys are hired guns. It never lasts. It literally never lasts.
Yeah. Yeah, so you guys are all played on your own on your albums, and there was no studio players. It was your guys that were playing.
We'd always have friends come in. Like none of us were really strong like keys players, so we'd have people come in for those little things that we weren't so good at. But no, we very much played on our records, and our records are like, they sound pretty good, but they're also like, they're indie rock records. Like they're a little scrappy, and two of us were well trained. Me not being one of those. And then I'm very self-taught. So we weren't like, a couple of us are really high level musicians, and I bring more of like, I think I more of my like lyric writing and singing is what I bring. I'm not like, I'm always the first to say, like, I don't even call myself a musician. Really. I'm more of just singer songwriter is what I say, because I work with a lot of real musicians and I know that I'm not that.
You know? Yeah. I get that 100%. That's like saying you're a golfer.
Exactly.
No, I play golf. I am not a golfer.
Yeah, exactly.
100%. So when you got in with this label, like what did you what was your feeling at that time? Like, so like, wow, we made it. We're number. And then where did it take you? Like you said, you toured quite a bit. Like, where mm-hmm. would you have gone?
It was exciting. It was an exciting time because it, when someone from the industry invests in you, you're just like, well, we must be doing something right. Mm-hmm. But it comes with a lot of pressure and a lot of expectation, especially as I said, like Larry was an old school guy at the time. Like he was in the latter half of his career, and yeah. his belief, not that he was alone in this, but it was like, you get on the road and you live on the road. Like we toured heavily. We'd go across the country and back many times, like all the way to BC, all the way to Victoria and back home, do the whole country. We did two pretty extensive tours of Australia.
Wow.
Which were fun, but tough. Like, honestly, they're pretty hard. We went to Germany. We, bopped into a few like one-offs in like Switzerland and some different shows when we were over in Europe. We got to do this cultural exchange where we went to India and played like four shows. Like,
no way.
I always say to people, like, I work with students now who are looking to get into the music industry, and it's like, I can't promise you anything as a person studying music. What I can promise you is that, like, you're going to get good training here, and it could go in a million different directions, but it very much depends on what you're good at, what you're interested in. But as guys from Charlottetown who just wrote a few pop songs, and the places we got to go and the people we got to meet through that is absolutely still astonishing to me. That's so crazy. It's a great, even if, you know, it depends on what your goals are. Like, you know, it's not about making $1 million, but it's about experiences and just where, you know, I'll say we went much farther with this band than I would have ever imagined. So
really,
that's really okay. Because we were so young, we started it. Everything was an amazing, you know, something we wouldn't have expected. Like even our first shows, playing in front of a couple hundred people. Wow. Like it was like, we can stop now. This is as good as it's going to get.
We made it.
Yeah. We made it, you know? Yeah. And we talk about that a lot with young musicians. Well, what is making it mean to you? That could mean something very different to different people. And there's no right answer on that. But I feel we are successful because we did much more than we imagined doing. So, you know, we went down to, I'll probably keep thinking of different places we went, but we got to go down to South by Southwest in Austin, Texas a few times.
Cool.
Austin's just a magical place. Just got to visit some really cool places. But I always tell people, it's, you know, people snicker when you're touring. They kind of think it's a big joke and it's really easy. But my God, really, really hard.
You look at routine, like you're completely out of your routine. You're going from, you have no idea where you're going. You don't know what this next venue, or you don't know what you're going to be eating, or you don't know like if the bus is going to, or the car, or whatever you're in is going to break.
It's true. It's a very difficult day-to-day existence, and it's not very healthy, and you can't count on anything really that like any of your comforts that you're used to. So, that was getting to us by the end for sure. Like we'd reached a kind of a plateau as what we were doing and kind of doing the same tour over and over. And, we're like, no, I don't think we want to keep doing this.
Wow. Who was the first person to mention it? Like, would there have been one person, or would you guys all kind of like just sitting around kind of just come to a decision?
I think no one really wanted to bring it up.
Yeah,
but I think we were all on the same page. I remember it was that Germany trip. It was cool, but it was getting to the point where the benefits of doing that were no longer outweighing our desire to like actually have a little more stability in our lives or to spend more time at home. You know, a couple of us were in long-term relationships and things like that. And it was just like, no, this is, I forget who broke the seal in terms of bringing it up, but it was pretty unanimous once we started talking about it at that point.
Wow.
So that probably was 2011 or 12. And then I'm happy that we were in a space where we could go out in a cool way. And we did a small Canadian tour. And I think most of like hardcore people that came to see us many times had that opportunity to come out one more time, knowing that this was going to be it. So that felt good to end it that way. But it's funny, my wife and I were just talking about last night about the period after that. And that was probably the most difficult time in my life, because you kind of, your identity was gone. And I didn't know what to do. And I kind of, my wife was like, it's almost like you were 20 again, being like, what do I do with my life? Except everyone's expecting you to be so much further along because of your age. It was very difficult, very, very personally, very difficult. And I'm in a great place now, but wouldn't want to go back to that time for anything.
Well, and you look at, again, you go, that correlation to sport and an athlete, like someone who's, you know, talk about maybe an NHL or whatever, 32 years old, you're done. You're no longer a player. You're no longer doing the big lights. What are you doing now?
It's a great analogy, because you become you're that hockey star and that the guy that went away and made it into a big league, whatever it is. That's how, what people think when they look at you. And if you don't have that anymore, what are you at that point? I remember I got to know Dave Bedini a little bit from the band, the Rio Statics, and he's a great author as well. He's an amazing writer. I got to know him through an event, and he reached out to me. Because I was kind of basking in this final tour, and of course, there's lots of love coming our way during that. And he was like, Liam, like, just be careful. Like, this is going to be really hard after that. Because he went through almost the same trajectory, because the Rio Statics now are kind of like 2 hours traffic. Like, they're back together and they'll play shows and they release the odd album, but they're not doing it in the way they did when they were kids. Mm-hmm. But he said, yeah, that period when your band is done, he's like, it probably, you know, he was right. It's going to be extremely hard.
Man. So is that something that you might teach in your, like, so in the courses that you're doing, would you teach that aspect? Like, be careful with it. Because, I mean, mental health is a buzzword, you know, and everybody has mental health. It's whether it's good or it's not good, right? Yeah. But is that something that you might kind of bring up in the, yeah, okay, this is something, but here on the back end, like, you should be worried about your, you know, where your investments are and your mental health after all this. Like, is that brought up in coursework?
One thing I'm proud about in our program is that we have music business courses that force the students, for a lot of them, it's going to be theoretical at this point, but it's like, what are your revenue streams? Like, are you not everyone's a composer. Not everyone loves it, like, envisions themselves on the road. So every student's kind of project or that assignment will look different for everybody, because they all have different strengths and interests. But we definitely open up those conversations. So how, you know, you're a good musician. Now, what happens next? How do you turn that into a career? So they're so young, most of our students, that it is theoretical at that point. They're still figuring out who they are as a musician. But we do also get students who are already a little bit further along. And that's when I don't force anything on anyone, but if they come to my office and want to talk about these things, I'm very happy to have, you know, pass along what I've learned and what my experience was. And especially, you know, we've had groups of students form that, you know, things can happen really quickly in the music industry. Like, if you're right group at the right time, like in our region, if you're like a Celtic or Acadian act that is fresh and doing something new with it, I mean, the sky's the limit for you. So I've seen bands like that come together, and then all of a sudden it's like 5 months in, they're getting these contract offers, come to Ireland, do this. Yeah. And it's very overwhelming. So I think that I'm very happy to have those conversations with them and just say, here's what to look out for and think about. And these are all good things, but now you got to start taking care of yourself, and money wise, mental health wise, you know, don't make every night on the road a party, because that's going to cut things off for you pretty quick. So, you know, if someone's ready to have that conversation, I'm always happy to pass along what I've learned. The funny thing is, like, I'm already like a dinosaur. Like, the industry has changed so much. We try and keep up, and we do, you know, it's like professional development for us. We have to stay on top of where things are. But the industry I was in and the from 2000 to 2010 is simply not,
it's gone.
It's not the case anymore. That's not it.
Yeah. What have you noticed? What is it now? Like, what is the big difference between when you, like the 2000, 2010 to now? Like, so you got these young artists that are starting out or older ones. Like I've been going now, like, I guess 8 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's even in that, and I haven't done as nearly as much as what you did. Like it's been weird to navigate. You know, that it's like you said, it's ever changing super quick. So how do you stay on top of it? Like, how do you advise these kids that,
it's like any, you know, I don't just work at the music program at the college, and whether you're doing graphic design or journalism or whatever the case is, most of our instructors were successful at one time in their industry. That's kind of our model at the college. But then you've got to do the readings. Like you've got to read articles. You've got to stay in touch with your contacts, and you've got to extract that information as much as possible. Because if we only talk about our experience, it's not going to be the experience the students have. So it's a challenging thing. You're always playing catch up. But like when we used to go on tour and sell CDs. Like a lot of CDs.
Yeah.
Like there were nights we would sell 40 to 50 CDs in a club that might have had 400 people on it. Like 1 in 10 people were buying a CD and going home with that CD. We, towards the end of our touring life, like we saw that completely dry, almost completely dry up. Yeah. And then you were like focusing on t-shirts or other things that you can't get on a streaming service. I remember friends of mine they kind of started a bit later than us and lasted a bit longer. They'd be there sitting at the merch table after the show, and someone would come up and say, and this one, Spotify was relatively new, say, "Are you on Spotify?" And they just kind of be like, "I don't know. I don't really know what you're talking about." And they're like, "Oh, you are on it. So I don't have to buy." And they're essentially, I don't have to buy the CD because it's right here and it's free. And it's like, "Ooh, that's not good."
Yeah. Jaw drops.
So we are in the era that's dominated by streaming, as you well know. And it's incredibly problematic. Like I, as a music fan, I have a Spotify account. I love being able to listen to all that music, but I've also done a lot of reading and research into the business model, and it's disastrous. It's not even good for them. They don't even make a profit. Spotify has never turned a profit. I don't want to get in my soapbox here, but
is that right? I didn't know that.
People are usually very shocked. I when I say that, but their financials are online. Anyone can see them. They're public documents. As much as you and I get very little money from those streams, when you take into account all of the streams that they pay out and to the labels and to the Taylor Swift and stuff of the world, they pay out more than comes in. And most people don't realize that. It's like they're basically it's a dying thing. Like it won't last forever. I don't think it'll have to look different because their shareholders don't get money back. Like
crazy.
It's not a good business model. And it's obviously, you know, I have people that completely disagree with me on this and talk about how it's just a promotional tool. You shouldn't expect money from it. And I get that, but it's like nothing has replaced the selling of physical media. And it's fascinating to me because this is not a sustainable model, I don't believe. So we will see new innovations. I don't know what they will look like.
Have to be.
There has to be, because at some point someone's going to go, "I'm not going to keep put my money in Spotify because I'm not getting any money back from it." The only reason I know this stuff, because I didn't, when I was younger, I tried to, I only care about the art. I don't want to know about the music business side, but I ended up doing through my job. I had to do a master's. They said, you know, that was required. So I found a program that was online that allowed me to do a focus on the music industry. So I got to take 4 or 5 courses from Berklee College of Music that were about the music, the industry side of music. So that's the only reason I know any of this stuff.
Wow, man.
Yeah.
That's crazy though. Like it like there's so much pressure and emphasis to get on Spotify and to get music into Spotify, pre-save it on Spotify and other platforms, but Spotify seems to be the predominant one.
It's
that's so insane. One, maybe that's why they're trying to get their money back. Who knows, man?
Like, you know how they went into podcasts and they started buying they bought Joe Rogan's podcast and all that stuff. That was an effort to start turning a profit. They're like, well, with the podcast, we can own it, right?
Right.
Whereas they don't, the thing is, all the music that's on the platform, they don't own it. It's somebody else's. They have to pay for it. As much as we complain about these horrible streaming cuts, at the end of the day, their pockets are empty too. It's so weird. I don't know. I'm not a business expert, but I think a lot of tech startups that go on to success, it's like your Twitters and stuff. It's like they have all these users, they're household names, but it doesn't mean it's a profitable business model. Right. So I think I don't know enough to know how these things work, but it's like, okay, well, if you have that many users, it justifies staying thing, and maybe we'll find a way to make a profit later. But right now, it's just, you're just there and you're just kind of slowly bleeding money.
Gosh, pivot.
Yeah. Yeah. And from what I've read, the podcast pivot did not pan out very well. For
I can't imagine, not unless they're getting, advertisers or sponsorship or some sort of thing like that, because I can tell you, like, this podcast makes $0. In fact, it cost me money. So
most creative pursuits tend to be like that.
but it's just a fun thing and an itch to scratch, right? So that's funny, man. Wow. So you guys got back together now. Now you're putting your stuff out on Spotify and stuff like this. What's the plans? Are you going to get back into any kind of touring at all? Or are you kind of happy just to play locally? Or
I think we've maxed out our poor local market here. We definitely have, still have some fans around, but I think we're at a point, we just got to this point again, where kind of the writing was on the walls. Like, are we just doing our two local shows a year, or do we want to try to do something a little bit more? And the farthest we've gone in our discussions is let's record a handful of songs. We're up to maybe 6 new songs, and let's record them all and only pick the best two. Like, new music after all this time, we got to come out the gate with something really good. Like, that's what we're thinking. So we'll start with whatever is kind of bang into our ears. We'll put that out. And my dream is that we do a very quick and fun little Canadian run, like get a Toronto show on there, pluck out, 6 or 7 cities on the way home, go out for 10 days, 14 days. And that would be like, that will scratch all of our itches. We're not looking to go back to what we used to do by any means. But I think it would be fun. If people want to come to those shows, we would like to play them, is kind of what it comes down to. And without something, what have you done for me lately? If you don't have something new to share, you can only run on that nostalgia for so long. And I think locally, we've had great support from people coming out to shows, but I think no one has said this to us, but I'm getting the vibe. They're like, okay, what do you got? Like, what are you going to do? You're going to actually record some music for us. So we're feeling that too. And it's been a real blast just writing these new songs, and whether this plan works out, whether they get recorded, or whether anyone hears them, I won't regret writing the tunes again, because it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. The hang is so cool, right? Like, it's just even jamming it out with the guys is like, We rehearse in a garage, and I don't know if you're doing it in a studio or not, but it's just such a, like, there's a motorbike beside us, there's a quad over there, there's a beer fridge. Know what I mean? Like, it's super cool.
Our friend Roger, this rehearsal space is limited in Charlottetown. It's a bit of an issue. So everyone has their little spot that they know about, but our friend Roger, who's a great musician in his own right, he has the coolest, it's got to be the coolest basement in the province. it's very 70s, like, carpet wallpaper. He's maintained it, and it's a very old house, and it's lined with guitars, organs. He's a collector of gear. So it's like the perfect environment to be creative. And those things are important. Like, the lighting and the space and everything. And this is just a really good space for us. And we're a four piece, so it's not very big, but it's perfect size for us. So it's very, to me, it's like a night out. Like I get the social aspect. And then we're also doing something that could lead to be, you know, something more than just a hangout, but it is, even if it's just a hangout, it's very satisfying in its own right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's fun, man. How do you guys use, like, are you like using acoustic drums down there and stuff too? Or are you like on the digital, it's like quiet?
He rents it out as an actual practice space and has for years. So we bring our little wad of cash down and leave it there. And, you know, he has children as well. And they, nobody knows more about the Charlottetown music scene than them, because they hear the tunes coming through the basement. But it's a great place to jam. And I'm always saying, like, you know, we're scheduling things and I'm sure you know how hard that can be when you're our age. And it's like, I'm like, why don't we just do it on Friday or Saturday? Then it's our going out. It's our night to go out and we get some work done. So, that's an ideal Friday night for me.
Yeah, man. It's exactly what it is here too. Like it's, especially with kids. Mm-hmm. How old are your kids now?
7, 4, and 2.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, like as they get even older and into the sports that you were in, and oh man,
we're just getting into stuff now, and it's like, wow, I don't know how much more. We better get the music recorded soon. Yeah. Might not have a lot of time,
and buy whatever gear you need now, because you're not gonna they're taking all your money later, I can tell you that.
I think you're absolutely right on that too.
Jeez.
Yeah, thankfully I'm not a big gear head. I have my guitar that works. As long as my guitar works, I'm good to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have just the one then? Like, or do you, like,
I have a few. I have I mostly write on a little classical guitar.
Okay, cool.
I find it's helpful for me to, like the way you can pluck out a melody on those strings is very kind of defined. I kind of hear the notes and the chords in a way that helps me to write on that. And then what I play live is, just like a middle of the road Yamaha acoustic with a pickup, but it's a beautiful guitar. Like I've always liked Yamahas and Yamaha acoustics. That's my main performing guitar. And then I have a couple of like knockoff Telecaster electrics that have kind of, they're in my possession. I don't know how it happened over the years, you know, like a friend was like, I don't want this anymore, or a move happened or whatever. Yeah. So I've got my small fleet, but I'm not like when you talk to, I don't know if you talk to Nick about his guitars, but like he would have more than a dozen probably.
The pedal board looks like a spaceship. Yeah. Yes, I don't know how they do it, man.
I'm not that kind of musician. Like I'm like, here's my song. I'll strum the 3 chords. That's what I can do for you.
That's in my wheelhouse right there, brother. I think we
fill the same role.
Yeah. My pedal's a tuning pedal. That's it. That's the only one I got. Yeah. I have nothing else.
I'm the exact same.
Yeah. Love it. Awesome. Well, what's next then? What's up on the horizon for you coming up?
So in the midst of all this, like when 2 Hours Traffic stopped touring, I've never stopped writing and recording. So I'm actually set to release my 4th solo effort summer.
Awesome.
So July 7th is the release date. And I'm at a point now where like sometimes I'm doing a Liam Corcoran show, sometimes it's 2 Hours Traffic show. But to me, it's all just, you know, writing songs and playing them with people I like. So, I've got a 9 song album coming out, in July. I recorded it in Toronto, in a very short 3 days last summer.
Oh, wow.
With my friend Brian Murphy, who produced and played most of the instruments, and, happy with how it turned out. I made a couple of, we're getting a couple of videos edited right now to help promote it. So I'm just hitting the, like, it's going to be a short and sweet promotion cycle leading up to July. And we timed it that way because there's a new festival in Cavendish PEI where they do Cavendish Beach. Yeah. They're keeping all the gear there essentially, and they're going to do more of a rock festival,
Somo or something.
I think the pronunciation is Somo. I'm pretty sure, but I got a slot on that, so we're kind of basing the release date around that. And
cool.
So it'll be a fun summer getting, you know, see what people think once they get the record out there. But it's really churned out in a way that I'm sure, you know, you make something, you're really excited, but as it creeps closer to the release date, you start to get like more insecurities about it. And I'm not feeling a whole lot of jitters about this one. I feel I did what I wanted to do and I like the song. So it's kind of like, you know, if people like it, that's gravy, but you kind of have to please yourself first.
I just read, and I don't know if you've read it yet, Rick Rubin, The Creative Act.
I'd love to read that, but no, I haven't read it. Oh,
it's fantastic. And in there, one of the things that he actually says was the last person or the last people that you care about is the audience. He said, you need to love what you're doing yourself. Yeah. And once you're happy with it, then it's up to, if they like it, they like it, but whatever. It's the, like, it's you.
I believe that some people disagree with that. If they're really entrenched in the industry side of it, but really, if you're looking at it as an artist,
yeah.
If you don't like it, then it's probably not gonna be able to sell it to anyone else.
Exactly. Right. Flush it. Like, you know, yeah. So that's, it was really, it resonated with me because I was like, it put me at ease as a bit of a, you know, from the creative side on the songwriting, like, you know, instead of chasing a commercial type feel, it was like, yeah, just put down what you, and that's one of the things, like, I listened to some of your stuff on the giving tree, I think, mm-hmm. it was and the other song, and that was awesome. And and Lawrence Maxwell was another one that where I just found that it wasn't just cookie cutter, you know, and that's the part that I really enjoyed. So
that's what's nice about the PEI scene is that we're quite far removed from the industry, so like it's not that we don't do good things and go on tours and all that, but we're not so entrenched in it that we're really chasing anything. I don't think we know what to chase. You know?
Yeah, true. Yeah. Attract instead of chase. Yeah.
That's a good way.
Yeah.
Frame it. Hopefully it's, we'll attract someone.
That's not mine. I wish I could take that. That's someone else. I can't remember who said it, but yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure it's someone famous, so I could definitely push you to that direction.
Yes.
Well, this has been cool, man. I appreciate you coming on the show here. And
thanks for having me. It was fun.
Yeah. We're closing about an hour here, I think. So, this leads to the final one. That's always the good question at the end because you never know what's going to happen. So, Liam, who should I be talking to?
I think you should talk to my friend and my colleague. Her name's Kiera Celeste.
Kiera Celeste.
So Kiera was a student in our program. Maybe about 5 years ago. She comes from New York State. And she's one of the best singers I've ever encountered in my life. And she's just she's an amazing person. She got through the program. She ended up she now teaches vocal lessons with the program. She's amazing songwriter and performer. And really, I think she's set to explode as an artist. Like, she has all the tools to go very far in the industry. And I was thinking about who I would pass the baton to. And I thought, what an interesting story she would have to tell.
Awesome. Yeah. That's exactly what this is all about. So, I mean, awesome. You never know who you're going to be talking to, but each person has been like someone that's been like super interesting that the world needs to know about kind of deal. So yeah, that's awesome, man. Well, I'm glad we got to connect. This is it's been like, just that word, awesome. It's just been perfect.
Well, I have to catch a performance of yours.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, I'm trying to think where we're. Well, Lawrence and I were actually, because of the country side of the house, talking about a little bit of a home and home type of deal and doing Trailside and the Carlton. So.
Oh, good idea. Yeah. Well, if you come over the island, I'll definitely try and get to that. That'd be fun.
Cool, man. All right. Well, let's plan that, and I'll stay in touch. I'll be looking for your new stuff for sure. And
I'll send you a note when it's all.
I'd love to. Yeah, and I'll pump it out for sure on my side too. Appreciate you, man.
Thanks, man. Nice meeting you.
You as well.
Ha! I told you it was going to be a great one. Liam Corcoran, everybody. Yeah, what a great, great individual. Make sure you check out July 7th, he said. His album is dropping. He's got a new solo album with 9 songs on it. It's his 4th solo album. Keep an eye out for 2 Hours Traffic because they're doing some good things. And just take a trip to PEI. It's awesome. Really looking forward to meeting Kiara. Kiara Celeste is his recommendation, and I know nothing about her other than what he just told me, which is pretty much par for the course for this podcast. And I gotta put out this gratitude just into the world for this, because it's just been an outstanding experience not knowing who I'm going to meet every week and just expanding the circle. And it's just, I hope it's been as good for you guys as it has for me. I can tell you that it's something that I look forward to every week, and I'm really looking forward to keeping this one going. So we will see you next time on the Who Should I Be Talking To podcast, where I won't know who I'm going to be talking to. The hell I be.
Please. Oh. Honey?